You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, it is amazing what is going on in the Senate right now. Or not in the Senate, actually in Nashville. And also in this whole Republican race, but they're kind of a couple of separate stories. Some fascinating things here, though. First of all, the ongoing breaking news, I suppose you could call it. Rand Paul showed up at the airport. He went into the Chertoff porno scanner, and it found an anomaly. Hey, there's something there. So they find an anomaly. They patch it down. And he said, no, I don't think you're going to pat me down. I don't think that's constitutional. I have not committed a crime. There's no evidence I've committed a crime. I mean, I have no idea what words he said, but this is the argument that he has made and his father has made repeatedly, and many of us make, that the Fourth Amendment explicitly says that you shall be secure in your persons, in your person and effects, et cetera. I'll give you the exact language here. The right of the people to be secure in their persons. I think that means your body, right? And your clothes. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, paper, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. Unless somebody actually swears under oath before a judge that they have evidence that, you know, there's probable cause to believe a crime has been committed. That last part was my language rather than the Fourth Amendment's, but it's basically that's what it says. But here's what I find particularly interesting. Article 1 of the Constitution talks about an exemption that senators and members of the House of Representatives have, not presidents or members of the Supreme Court, interestingly, but only members of the House and the Senate. Because they're the closest to the people. They're the ones who are supposed to make the laws. Don't tell the Supreme Court that. They think that's their job. But in any case, they carved out an exemption for themselves. It's the equivalent of diplomatic immunity. You know, diplomatic immunity, you've got some guy. It's the MacGuffin in a lot of movies over the years, you know, where the diplomat from Turkey, Wikistan, something or other country, comes to the United States and kills somebody or rapes somebody or robs somebody or something, and the police show up and say, okay, buddy, you're going to the Huskow, and the guy pulls out his diplomatic passport and says, you can't arrest me, I'm a diplomat. And he's right. I mean, that's the deal we made when we joined the United Nations, is that maybe even long before that, the diplomats have immunity in the United States. In fact, it may be in the Constitution. I'm not sure. I'd have to go digging through that. But I can tell you that there's an equivalent of that for members of the House and Senate when they're traveling to and from work. So Rand Paul has been detained by the TSA in Nashville because he would not submit himself to a grope. And here's what it says. This is Article 1, Section 6 of the Constitution. The senators and representatives shall receive a compensation for their services to be ascertained by law and paid out of the Treasury of the United States. Okay, so we're talking about senators and representatives. They shall in all cases accept treason, felony, and breach of the peace. Now, there are some exceptions there. Treason, felony, or breach of the peace. None of which I think Rand Paul committed in the Nashville airport. Be privileged from arrest during their attendance at the session of Congress, of their respective houses, and of going to and returning from the same. So he shouldn't, I mean, you know, not that I'm some big Rand Paul fan, I think he's a wackadoodle, but the fact of the matter is that according to the Constitution, members of Congress shouldn't even have to go through the metal detectors. And frankly, I don't think the rest of us should have to either. I think the whole thing is absurd. It's security theater. I do not believe that after 9/11, anybody could pull off a hijacking of an airplane without the passengers taking them down. I just don't believe it. And You know, we're spending billions of dollars to turn America into a nation of sheeple, to use Mike Malloy's term. And it's just, it's nuts. Okay, meanwhile, some folks are calling out Newt Gingrich and, well, I was going to say Mitt Romney, but it's pretty much been Newt Gingrich on his racially coded language. James Clyburn, I don't have a source for this, Jacob, on the sheet. This was CNN, wasn't it? Yeah, okay. Here's James Clyburn on CNN.
I mean, is that necessarily a sort of a racist comment?
Well, it's not necessarily so, but people know what that means. Richard Nixon, a Southern strategy. Now, all of this carries certain connotations that people know very, very well. I'm saying that he is appealing to an element in his party that will see President Obama as different from all other presidents that we've had.
Right. And this is the class warfare is one piece of this, but the racial piece is the really, really nasty underbelly of this. When Richard Nixon said he was going to pursue a Southern strategy, Bill Moyers on Bill Maher's Real Time with Bill Maher last Friday was telling a story that I'm pretty sure he told on this program a couple of years ago. I know I've heard him tell it, and he's been on this program a number of times, where after Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act, he was, you know, Bill Moyers came, you know, brought him some papers and things, and he said to Bill Moyers, I think I've just handed the Republicans the South for my lifetime and yours. And at that time, Lyndon Johnson was in his 60s and Bill Moyers was in his 30s. And so that's quite some time. And of course, Richard Nixon then immediately comes out with the Southern strategy, which is, okay, let's find the white racists in the South and make them Republicans. And the white racists in the South had traditionally been Democrats, George Wallace Democrats. And rather than, and so the Democratic Party said, okay, that's it. We're no longer the party of racists. And the Republican Party stepped up and said, Papa, we will be. There are voters to be had. It's really quite incredible when you think about it. And then on top of this, there's this class warfare thing. And here's the thing I found most astounding about this. David Gregory, you know, Face the Nation, or Meet the Press, or whatever it is. David Gregory apparently actually believes that the president's strategy is going to be class warfare. Clip 3-1, Jacob.
Can you have a Republican nominee who can really play into the class warfare argument that the president wants to make against Republicans generally?
That the class warfare argument that the president wants to make? Now, this is a reporter. I don't recall the president having said he was going to make a class warfare argument. I don't recall there being a class warfare argument. Unless you're, I don't know, a multimillionaire candidate. I mean, he asked this was a question in the debate, and both Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich answered it, and in both cases their answers were these rants about how Obama is the welfare president, he's the class welfare president, he's going, you know, he's the anti-opportunity president, blah blah blah. And you know, basically what it is they're defending a country that over the last 30 years, as the result of Reaganomics, has become the least socially mobile country in the developed world. Now, Americans are starting to catch on to this, but apparently the Republicans think it'll still work for them to trash poor people or black people.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So where should we all call our representatives and say, hey, stand with Rand Paul and don't get groped and don't go through the scanners? Right, 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Racially coded language, it's really quite remarkable what's going on in the Republican side. There's another Republican debate tonight, another one Thursday. The State of the Union address is tomorrow. Tomorrow, by the way, Mitt Romney's going to release his tax returns tomorrow. Not because it's the State of the Union and he's trying to grab the news cycle, but because that's when his bookkeeper could get around to it. Right. I mean, Mitt Romney just can't afford to pay his bookkeeper overtime to do it on the weekend, to pull that thing out of the drawer that they filed a year ago and just say, here. So he's going to do it on Tuesday. Just a coincidence. And Rand Paul sitting in the airport in Tennessee, or in Kentucky, rather, excuse me. If I said Tennessee, I mix those two states up constantly. My apologies. It's what happens when you grow up in Michigan, and it's them states down south of us. Charles in Reagan, Tennessee, just next door. Hey, Charles, your thoughts on this?
How you doing?
Good. What's up?
I'm a member of the ACLU, and I do have a copy of the Constitution, and I was listening to what you were saying about the representative from Nashville. I feel safer being on a plane knowing that everybody in public transportation has some type of security that measures that they have got to go through. These people are our public representatives, and they should be setting an example. And also, I understand that your constitutional rights end where mine began, and my constitutional rights end where yours began.
Well, that's the old line of my right to swing my arm ends at the tip of your nose.
That
has nothing to do with, frankly, getting on an airplane. And the Constitution explicitly says that you will not be searched unless there is some evidence that you've committed a crime. Now, I have no problem at all with people showing up at the airport and presenting ID and saying, this is who I am, and even government-issued ID. We're not talking about the right to vote here. And the government having a database, and if somebody has sworn before a judge that this person is probably a terrorist, or this person may have, an FBI agent has sworn before a judge or whatever, stopping that person from getting on the plane or even searching them. I got no problem with that. If there's evidence that they are going to commit a crime on that plane. But to say, I mean, where are we going to stop? You know, if you're in your car, you can, and you go out on the highway and you time it right and you do it right, you could probably put 10, 15, 20 cars into a car accident. You could kill a lot of people intentionally with your car. Shall we search? Shall we grope people before they get in the cars? And for that matter, if you're looking for genuine, somebody who's really a serious terrorist, do you think that they're not going to think that it's possible to put 2 ounces of C4 explosive, which is enough to easily take down an airliner, in a, shall we gently say, a body cavity? I mean, people are smuggling heroin that way every single day.
That's true. I hadn't considered some of these things. I really do appreciate your show, and I just want to thank you for being able to allow me to put what I was thinking.
Sure.
And I don't want this to turn into a nation where we are without rights.
Thank you, Charles. Thank you very much. And my apologies if I came off like I was just whacking
upside
the head.
Your show has taught me so much you wouldn't believe.
Okay.
And I also subscribe to the Nation magazine.
Yeah.
And you bring forth people from the Nation magazine that puts faces to some of the articles that I read.
Yeah, yeah.
There's some
good people.
And I like that,
Charles.
Charles,
thank you very much. I got to move along here. I got a bunch of callers, but thank you for your kind words and thanks for calling in. JJ in Atlanta. Hey, JJ, what's up?
Hey, good to talk to you, Tom. I want to explain what's going on here. I grew up in South Mississippi during the time of the civil rights problems, and also was appalled way back when. Ronald Reagan decided to go to Philadelphia to make his
Philadelphia, Mississippi, a little town of 6,700 right. people that murdered 3 civil rights workers back in the 60s.
That's right, and we're proud of it. Now, the chief problem with most of these folks is that it's the White House, not the Black House.
Yeah.
Okay? It starts there.
Yeah. It's the white racist saying, what's going on here with this black guy living in our White House? Yeah.
And what I noticed out of the South Carolina debates is what we heard was a group of people whose lives are based on fear and hate, not hope and compassion.
Yeah.
That's the big problem. That's how they live under hate. And one other last thing. I'm desperately trying to reframe the issue. These folks are regressives. There's nothing conservative about them. basically regressives.
Yeah, yeah, they're the Neanderthals of American politics. Good point, JJ. Thank you very much, Jonathan in Malvern, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jonathan, what's up?
Hey, yeah, obviously not every Republican's a racist or a bigot.
Sure.
But the two major platforms the Republicans stand on are fossil fuels and bigotry.
Yeah. I'm not sure I would say bigotry, totally racially bigotry, but I think that the, you know, class bigotry is, you know, another dimension of it as well. I mean, you know, they're basically, you know, they're the party of by and for the rich. I won't disagree with that point. Linda in Cortland, New York. A minute to the break. Linda, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was wondering if you know of any reason why the media or any of the Occupy Wall Street movements have not broached the subject of repealing both the Patriot Act 1 and 2, which it directly infringes on our constitutional rights.
Well, Rand Paul, the guy who just got stopped at the airport, and again, I'm not a libertarian and I'm not a booster of most of Rand Paul's ideas, but he has suggested that, as has his father. And Bernie Sanders has suggested that on the left. So I think it's a good idea.
I've been a political artist for 30 years, and I've been told that I was the conspiracy theorist, but the group that I was with in New York City had seen the fall of Wall Street, but we thought it was going to be in another area of the Federal Reserve money.
Yeah.
The fall way before it happened.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, the housing bubble burst in 2006, and that's when I was saying, get ready, it's coming. Thank you very much for the call, Linda. We will continue. Actually, there's a lot more in the news that I want to get to as well. Did you know that the USDA is privatizing poultry inspection? Guess what? It's not working out so well. Yeah. Is your food safe?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, a cheesy news alert. Why has President Obama been laughing lately? Oh, not like that.
And these heartless friends that you like to hang around, when they look my way, they're always looking down. And I'm tired of you spending every dime I make to finance this way of life I've learned to hate. I'm going back to a better class of losers. But it's uptown living that really got me down.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman with you. Amazing. Our cheesy news alert for the day. White House aides are alarmed by uncharacteristic behavior on the part of President Obama, who they say has been laughing uncontrollably since 7 p.m. Saturday night. The aides, who spoke on condition of anonymity, said that they heard unusual howls coming from the Oval Office just after the 7 o'clock hour on Saturday evening, causing them to rush to the president to ascertain the cause of the uproar. It was weird, one aide said. He was just watching cable news. The staff members thought little of the normally reserved president's giggle attack until it continued throughout the weekend, which saw Mr. Obama laughing uncontrollably and stopping only for gasps of air. Ever since Saturday, Mr. Obama has been oddly giddy throughout White House staff meetings, the aide said, and has been seen noodling the initials NG in the margins of memos like a love-struck schoolgirl. The only thing we can think of that NG might stand for is not good, the aide said. But why would he be so happy about something that's not good? Mr. Obama's high spirits were on evidence today in a brief White House appearance in which the president made the following statement about the administration's energy policies. Quote, going forward, the United States of America will... End of quote. Yeah. Thanks to Andy Borowitz, tongue-in-cheek, of course, for our news report. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And this is very, very... interested. This is the whole thing I find very interesting. Daniel in Peoria, Illinois. Hey, Daniel, what's up?
Hey, Tom, good to talk to you. How are you doing today?
Very well, thank you. And I'll get better.
Hey, just a quick note before I get to what I wanted to talk about. I think what Charles in Tennessee might have been saying is that as long as we have to be patted down and pour no x-ray and all of that other good stuff at airports, it's nice that senators and congressmen might have to stand for the same.
I agree. I agree with that sentiment, you know, that they're not a royalty that should be above us. My point is that none of us should have to go through that. That, you know, we flew in this country for years and years and years. We even had, you know, hijackings and things. I mean, there was an era when you just walked up and got on the airplane. And, you didn't even have to show ID. I mean, showing ID is like a good step. It's a good first step. And but I think that we've, you know, this is security theater. I mean, we have just turned it into a joke.
Yeah. What I wanted to call about, and it was nice that you mentioned the Barowitz report thing right there, is that all of the giddiness about the possibility of Newt Gingrich getting the nomination, it kind of seems to be one of those things where you're laughing that, oh, such a thing couldn't happen here. I think that guy, you know, has anybody who's nominated from the Republican Party is going to get 48% of the vote already, and that guy is just logical enough and rational enough in his evil to convince 3% of people, I think.
Sure.
He worries me. Yeah, he worries me hard.
Yeah, me too. And they all do. And let's not forget, back, you know, in 70, what was it, 6, I think it was, that Ronald Reagan challenged Jerry Ford in the primary. Everybody made fun of Ronald Reagan, including the Republicans made fun of Ronald Reagan. And then in 1980, when Reagan was nominated to run, everybody was like, oh, this is wonderful. All the Democrats, this is wonderful. This is just what we wanted. Ronnie Reagan, the guy who made movies with a chimp, right? This is perfect. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when he was governor of California, he people didn't like him, and he shut down the university system, or he entered the free university system, and, you know, quack, 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 and look what happened. And so, yeah, I'm with you, Daniel. Thank you for the call. We should not take any of this. We should not ignore any of this or not. We should not fail to take it seriously. Mindy in Denver. Hey, Mindy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Regarding being patted down at the airport,
yeah,
it occurs to me that nobody ever mentions that the few hijackers who caused 9/11 were on a no-fly list, but nobody seemed to pay attention to that.
That's correct.
And let them go through, even with box cutters, they let them go through. And now, the Bush administration, and now even more so, we've created a complete industry out of basically search and seizure at the airport.
Yep.
And, it's again, you know, the few who are guilty, the majority have to pay. How many millions of people go through the airports all the time?
Yes, and here's the point about the 9/11 hijackers. 14 of those guys were on the no-fly list. At that point in time, that no-fly list had 80 names on it, 80. That was it.
Wow.
And before 9/11. And, you know, now it's got, what, a 500,000, including dead people and heaven only knows, Ted Kennedy was on it, you know, for a year, couldn't get his name off. I mean, it's just, and you think there's no malice. First of all, had they simply been enforcing a no-fly list, a rational one that only had 80 names on it,
exactly,
those 14 guys would have gotten stopped. Secondly, they took down those planes with the box cutters in large part. Two thoughts on that. One is nobody expected that anybody would do anything like this.
Right.
So, you know, the passengers of at least three out of those four planes were not able to, or maybe it didn't even occur to them that they needed to stop these guys. They probably just thought it was going to be a normal hijacking and they were going to end up in Cuba, like, you know, it used to be back in the
70s. Yeah. Yeah.
And three, if you know, the box cutter, the part of the box cutter that you could use to cut somebody's throat is just one little tiny sliver of metal in the blade that could mm-hmm. easily be embedded in somebody's belt buckle or something like that, where it would easily go through security today. And then any kind of plastic that was designed to just slide that into to give yourself some leverage could turn it back into a box cutter. So our security right now does not protect us from what happened on 9/11.
I totally agree with that.
And so it's like, why are we doing all this if it doesn't even protect us from what happened on 9/11? It is, you know, as I said, and I'll continue to say it, it is security theater, and I agree with you, an industry has grown up around it. Mindy, thank you for the call. I think it's fascinating stuff when you look at it. Janice in Brandon, Vermont. Hey, Janice, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I am very upset about Newt Gingrich wanting the poor children to clean the toilets, and do the dishes and all that. You know, it's bad enough they were brought up poor.
Yeah.
Do they have to always be reprimanded?
Well,
I think he's a donkey. And he himself does not even look appropriate to be a president. He's sloppy looking.
Well, you know, just because somebody's kind of rumpled in their appearance, I don't think disqualifies them from being the president. I
don't either, but I don't think it makes him look like a good president.
Yeah, but, you know, Mitt Romney president. Looks like, you know, a Ken doll. Does that make him more presidential?
Right. No. No, but I think they should look neat. He does not look neat.
Okay. Well, we'll disagree on that, and we'll agree on everything else, okay?
Yes.
You know, I would like my president.
Yeah, that's okay.
You know, maybe I think, Janice, the point that you're making, and tell me if this is what you're trying to say. The president of the United States actually fills two roles that are two separate people in most other countries. In Israel, there's a prime minister and a president. In the United Kingdom and most constitutional monarchies throughout Europe, there's a prime minister and a king or a queen. And the king or queen in England or in Denmark or whatever, they are the head of state, and the prime minister is the head of government. So the prime minister does the work, you know, rolls up his sleeves and gets the work done. The head of state goes to the ceremonial functions and looks good. And and in Israel, the president doesn't have much power. He's the head of state. He goes to ribbon cuttings. The prime minister is the guy who actually does the work. In the United States, the president does both. And so I think what you're saying is that our president should look the role of head of state while he can also be the role of head of government.
And most of our presidents have.
Yes, well, at least in recent history.
Just cleaning the toilets.
Yeah.
I think this is terrible to do to poor children.
Yeah. No, I just
think it's terrible.
Yeah, I'm totally with you and totally agree. Thank you very much. Well said. Tupac in Phoenix. Hey, Tupac, what's up?
Yes, thank you, Tom, for taking the call. I was going to ask you, you could give us a reading, and maybe some of the readers might have an opinion, but these guys are talking lizard language, the reptilian brain. They're talking not logical, but to the gut of what I believe is the last flailing blows of white supremacy in America. Newt Gingrich used the term classical America in his attack against Obama's vision of what America is and can be still in the future. So what does he mean by that? What is he talking about, classical America? That's my question.
Yeah, well, I think when Newt Gingrich uses the phrase classical America, he means basically white people, white middle-class people.
But what is that? What is that? What is it to be a white person?
Well, I think maybe he means white middle-class racist people. You know, I frankly don't know. I'm as baffled as you are, Tupac. You could make the argument that if somebody is a genuine American, they're a Native American. I mean, that's the people who were here first.
Even before that, Tom, you know, America, that's an Italian name. We have our own name for this hemisphere, and believe it or not, it's not America.
Of course.
It goes beyond that. But
yeah.
My point is that the concept of white person itself is a pathology.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole concept of race is a pathology. Unfortunately, it's one we're not going to do away with a talk show, Tupac. But, you know, I'm with you. Thank you. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for listening there in Phoenix. We'll be back 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, shall we all call our members of Congress and say, stand with Rand Paul? Okay, the Republican Party has a problem on their hands. It's called Newt Gingrich, or maybe not. Maybe those very wise pundits in the media who are saying, oh, you know, Limbaugh is totally wrong when he says that Newt's the guy, or the right-wing talk show hosts who like Newt, or the Newt followers. You know, let's not forget that the things that they're saying about Newt, that he's unelectable, that he's wacky, that he's got a strange past, that he's had more than one wife, are all things they said about Ronald Reagan. I remember the first time, I remember back in the 70s when Reagan was running, when he challenged Jerry Ford. And the stories were coming out about how Ronald Reagan was having an affair with Nancy on his first wife. And I don't know if that's true or not. It doesn't much matter. But I remember coming, it's like you look at this and think, okay, there's no way this guy can win. And then suddenly the entire Republican establishment and all the millionaires and billionaires and large corporations in the country get behind him. And they can make a war hero like John Kerry look like a draft dodger. It's just incredible. Or, George W. Bush, he's so easy to take out. He was AWOL for a year. That's a federal felony. And he was drunk most of that time. He tore up the house that he was living in, left the people with a $12,000 bill for repairing it, hung from the chandeliers. Somehow that just didn't come up during the election. David, Ithaca, New York. Hey, David, thanks for listening to WNYY. What's up?
Thanks for taking my call. I had a legal thought, and being as how I'm not really an attorney, I wanted to run it by you and see what you thought.
Okay.
And it started out with this Citizens United issue with corporations allegedly being people now. And the idea is this. If one person gets laid off, that, harms that person and their family. It weakens them. If a division is laid off, that community is hurt and weakened and so on and so forth. Now, we've had outsourcing it's been going on for a long time now in this country, 30, 40 years, I guess. And it occurred to me that since we have enemies, pick a country that doesn't like us. We've always been told we have enemies. Isn't the weakening of America by this outsourcing a form of providing aid and comfort to these enemies, and therefore treasonous?
I'm not sure that legally you could make that argument, but I think morally you could make that argument, although I wouldn't even take it into the realm of enemies and war. I would simply say it's stupid.
It is.
The country should be self-sufficient. We should be making things here that we use, and we should be having jobs here domestically, But I get your logic, and I think that there are people who are actually follow that logic, and that was arguably a point that Ross Perot was making. David, thank you very much for the call. Well said. Lee in L.A. Hey, Lee, thanks for listening to KTLK. What's up?
Hey, Kyle, how you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
Okay, here's what. I was looking at, Newt Gingrich and the people he represents. Not all, Caucasian people are like him, but it's like they're taking the Constitution and they're saying, we the white people for the white people by the white people.
It seems.
It's like, huh?
I said it seems that that's what he's saying, yeah.
Yeah, and then to go back on this, to talk about this Iran, all these guys in the Republican Party want to go to war with Iran.
Yeah.
Now they're willing to, sacrifice some more American bodies like they did in Iraq. For something that's not a threat to us.
Well, not only that, not just American bodies. If Iran, if a war starts in the Middle East, it has the potential it's that World War I potential of just you have no idea where those dominoes are going to go. And I'm really afraid that they would go is Pakistan, India, which are both nuclear armed states and have a long animus.
And one more thing.
Yeah.
Russia and China have a pact with Iran that they will protect Iran.
Yeah. So there's my point. That's the World War. I'm not sure that they have actual treaties with Iran, but there are alliances. Alliances, and this is not the kind of thing that the United States needs to get into. It's insane. Yeah. Lee, excellent point. Thank you for the call. Debbie in Worthington, Massachusetts. Hey, Debbie, what's up?
Hi. I listen to your show almost daily, and I really appreciate everything that you make us aware of. I'm wondering, I'm frequently active, but it's very hard sometimes to ward off the apathy. And I was wondering if you have any insight into how to,
how to deal with all the bad news?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, it's let me give you a kind of 60-second thing from psychology. Most people who experience depression, kind of, you know, dark emotions that overwhelm them, are stuck in past, typically shame or guilt. Most people who experience anxiety are hallucinating, imagining future outcomes that they have created in their minds that scare them. And, you know, and the way that you treat those two things is by treating those kind of visualizations. And Debbie, thanks for the call. I'm going to drop the call and just finish this up. So what we need to do is hold a vision of an America that is egalitarian, where healthcare is a right, where a job is a right. I mean, the ideals, the second American Constitution, the second American Bill of Rights that Franklin Roosevelt proposed just before he died, where that has come to be. And America is a country where there really is equal opportunity for all, regardless of where they were born, regardless of their race, regardless of their parents' income, regardless of the region that they came from, regardless of, period. And hold that as a vision, and then take that positive vision out into the real world and get active, get involved in grassroots organizing, get involved in movement politics. Like movetoamend.org, for example.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The second hour of our program. Rand Paul apparently not on the airplane. The Supreme Court has ruled that you can't put a bug on somebody's car unless you actually have probable cause to believe that they committed a crime. Somebody has sworn to that before a judge and a warrant has been issued. So why should they be able to grope you? I mean, this is the Fourth Amendment. The first word of the things that are protected among the Fourth Amendment is persons. So anyhow, we'll get back to that, the whole, you know, what's going on at the airport thing and how we should respond and how everybody should respond in a few minutes. Right now, Steve Simpson is with us. He is a senior attorney with the Institute for Justice. IJ.org is the website, a libertarian public interest law firm, and standing up in favor, defending the Citizens United ruling that says that corporations are people, and not that money is speech, that the money facilitates speech. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. I'm sorry you didn't have the resources to come in by Skype. No, I'm serious. It would be great for our viewers to see you as well as.
Yeah, well, we might be able to do that at some point in the future. But,
okay, great. Why, you know, three years ago, before it, you know, a year before Citizens United, the majority of Americans thought that our campaign finance laws were screwed up, and in fact, the majority of Americans were opposed, for a variety of reasons. Some on the kind of, you know, there needs to be more. Some on the there needs to be less. But you know, there was a majority opposed to McCain-Feingold,
right,
specifically. Now we have a majority opposed to Citizens United, and I'm not suggesting that we should have government by polling or anything like that. But although you could argue that that's what elections are, but why? How can you possibly defend a Supreme Court ruling that says that, well, here's the phrase that you said. Congress has, this is from a quote from you in your brief.
Yep.
to Congress. You said, Congress has no more power to ban speech by American corporations than it does to ban speech from any American. Now, a corporation isn't a person. A corporation is a legal fiction that is created when you go to the Secretary of State's office and say, you know, I want to have special tax advantages.
Well, not quite. A corporation is a legal entity that's created by people.
Not necessarily. It could be created by a person.
Well, that's true. But just let me address some of your points here. First, corporations are made up of people. That's why corporations have to have the same rights in
but they are not.
Respects. They absolutely are.
They are not. The corporate form is a it exists as a figment of law, as John Marshall pointed out back in 1816, the third Supreme Court Justice of the United States, that and it was quoted in the dissent in Citizens United, as you well know, it is a figment of law. It is a corporation. You could have a group of people getting together, and you can call it anything you want, but if you're going to uniquely call it a corporation, it has to have a particular type of legal imprint established by a particular state or by an act of Congress.
Well, that's true, but Marshall, in that opinion, recognized the reason we have corporations is because it makes everybody's life better and allows people to organize their affairs in a much more efficient way than they could without corporations. We have all sorts of entities.
He also said they were soulless.
We have all sorts of entities in the law that aren't strictly speaking persons. Among them, government, by the way, and nobody claims that government has no legitimate right to function because it's not, quote, persons.
We're not talking about functioning. We're talking about free speech, and there are a lot of constraints on free speech within government.
That's true, but the Supreme Court has recognized that the government has the right to speak, as it absolutely has to if it's going to have the right to act. But ultimately, the reason to protect...
There is no... When did the Supreme Court say the government?
The government has a right...
There is no government.
No, that's absolutely right. This was a case... There are a number of cases in which the Supreme Court has held that the government, when it's talking about government affairs, has the right to speak, and every taxpayer doesn't have the right to tell it that because you're spending my money, you can't speak anymore. But
the specific agencies or individuals within the government.
Yeah, of course. I mean, but
okay, but that's my point. Is that an individual within a corporation has a right to speak, but the corporation itself doesn't.
On behalf of the corporation, just like the government has the right to speak on behalf of the government. It could be in no other way. But in any event, getting back to...
But the president can't speak on behalf of the government.
That's not true.
No, he can only speak on behalf of the executive branch. He can't speak on behalf of the Supreme Court.
Well,
he can't speak on behalf of Congress.
But the Supreme Court can speak on behalf of the Supreme Court. I mean, again, you're talking about entities within the government, and I think overcomplicating the basic point, which is that if individuals have the right to freedom of speech, they have to have the right to organize themselves into groups, and those groups then can speak for the individual.
That is called the freedom of association. The freedom of association and the freedom of speech are both the First Amendment, as you know.
Absolutely.
But they are not the same thing.
That's true, but they're logical corollaries of one another, and that's exactly where the right of association
arguably
comes from.
Arguably not. I mean, the right to associate, you know, is, I mean, that back, you know, back in the day when that First Amendment was written, the right to associate was associated with the right to conspire to bring down the government of Great Britain.
Well, not quite.
Or to kick out the government of Great Britain.
Not really. I mean, it was actually, I mean, it's written in the First Amendment as the right to assembly and the right to petition, which the court in the 1950s, in a case on behalf of the NAACP, held that there's a right of association. And that individuals obviously have to be able to get together in cooperative enterprises. Now, I'd be surprised if a majority of Americans opposed that, yet that is precisely what's at the heart of Citizens United. I mean,
you're misreading it, Steve. And you know this. You're an attorney. It says it says that the right of the people peaceably to assemble and, not or, but and, to petition the government for a redress of grievances.
That's
the right of assembly.
No, that's a serial and. That comes at the end of the amendment, and there are a number of different rights. So it's all of these are separate rights, and they're protected under this amendment. I don't think that's
okay.
Really...
You're right. I won't disagree with that. But in any case, my point is that the right peaceably to assemble.
Sure.
Doesn't mean that a corporation is a person.
That in it, no. And look, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that the assembly and petition prongs of the First Amendment were originally intended to.
But that's the argument you made before the Supreme Court.
No. The argument we're making is that the court has recognized a right of association, which is inherent in the First Amendment, and that has to apply to corporations just like any other group. But that's something that you don't really need. I don't think you need assembly and petition to get there. All you need is a protection for free speech, because if individuals have the right to choose to speak alone, they have to have the right to join with other people, any type of other group, whether it's a partnership, a marriage, a community organization, the Boy Scouts, the Girl Scouts, you know, a radio program, anything. I mean, and if we didn't protect this right, we wouldn't have rights to freedom of the press these days for media corporations or any other group, from the smallest neighborhood
up to the largest corporations. The press is specifically protected in the First Amendment. Corporations are not.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that part.
The press is specifically protected in the First Amendment. In fact, it's the only industry that is mentioned in the press and the post office are the only two businesses that are mentioned in the entire Constitution.
Yeah, but if you want to attack this from the original meaning, freedom of the press just meant a person with a printing press. It didn't apply to groups of people or any specific entity.
There were companies at the time printing newspapers.
Okay, and how does I don't see how that supports your argument.
Well, they were specifically protected. If the framers meant that any association of people had an absolute freedom of speech, then they wouldn't say. But and this one group in particular, the press, has a unique right.
No, you're reading that into the amendment, Tom. That's not what they said. They said freedom of the press. That means freedom of the printing press. It doesn't say anything about who is the entity operating the printing press.
Okay, so what do we lose? We have less than a minute, Steve. I'm sorry. What do we lose if we say to corporations, sorry, you can't speak as a corporation?
We lose the right of individuals to band together and speak effectively in any way that they want.
But the purpose of a corporation isn't to speak. It's to make money.
That's the purpose of some corporations, but in the context of making money, there's absolutely no good grounds to tell somebody that's making money that they're not allowed to speak, any more than it would be to say to the New York Times, your purpose here is profit, therefore you're not allowed to speak anymore. That would be insane.
Yeah, well, I'm in favor of the insane then. Steve Simpson, IJ.org, the website. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So is it insane to suggest that corporations should not be people? Check out movetoamend.org, see what they think.
People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power.
There you go. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Matt in Cleveland. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind?
Oh, yeah. I have a question regarding voter rights and the Constitution.
Yeah.
Since obviously they like to argue that money is speech, why wouldn't voting be a form of petitioning your government and therefore covered under the First Amendment? And therefore, you really couldn't take it away without and basically you would have to prove that the person didn't have a right to vote as opposed to the person proving you have a right to vote.
Right.
I've never understood that either.
My understanding of this, and I'm not a scholar on the history of voting rights over the years, but I'm pretty familiar with the thinking of a lot of the founders in the early years of this country and also with what happened during Reconstruction with the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, was that in the early on debates in the United States about how seats for the House of Representatives should be apportioned. The people in the southern states, particularly South Carolina and Georgia, at the Constitutional Convention said, we will not go along with this Constitution. In other words, there wouldn't be a United States of America. If you don't, for the purposes of figuring out how many members of how many delegates we can send to the House of Representatives, how many congressmen we have and women, I mean, back then it was congressmen.
Yeah,
if you don't count the slaves in our state for the purposes of giving us representation. Then the people in the North, where slavery was illegal, said, but you don't let your slaves vote. So if you're not going to let them vote, why should we count them toward apportionment in a representative body? And the people in the South said, well, okay, this sounds like a deal breaker. We're just going to split off and there won't be any United States. And the deal that was brokered by Madison on this thing and a few others, John Jay and others, was that they would, for the purposes of deciding how many people would go to the House of Representatives, they would take 3/5 of the slaves in any particular state, and so if there were 1,000, I don't know how to do the math, but anyhow, 3/5 of the number of slaves would be counted as people toward representation, and because of that very clumsy, very awkward, at the same time that they were writing into law that's the practice of slavery would pretty much end in the United States by 1808. It's in the Constitution, not that it would end, but that the importation of slaves would end and so on, that there wasn't any specific right to vote written in the Constitution. It was just implied and implicit. After the Civil War, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were passed, and the 15th Amendment explicitly, this is the first time the right to vote comes into the Constitution. And, it, of course, was written in there to protect the right of people who were African-Americans, who were former slaves. But it applies to everybody. It says, Section 1, this was passed in 1870, proposed in 1869, the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or accounted or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation, which they did. Well, they did sort of. I mean, we got separate, but Plessy versus Ferguson and all these kind of awful things. But
yeah.
But anyhow, that's my understanding of the history of it. But you know, your construction that the right to petition the government for redress of grievances should be construed as the right for voting, I'm guessing was probably made in the early days. In fact, it wouldn't surprise me at all if that was one of John Quincy Adams's things, because after he left the White House, he went back to Congress just to be a congressman, just to fight slavery and fought it ferociously. But it never took. You know, it was never held by the Supreme Court. So good point, Matt. Thank you for the call. And a lot to think about there. Valerie in Carson City, Nevada. Hey, Valerie, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
I just had a comment about this whole notion of corporations being people.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of the way I think about it, I think that corporations have more in common with robots than they do with people. And as such, that, you know, they're assembled by people, and they usually have a purpose, you know, a singular purpose. Like, they might be profit-driven, or they manufacture something, or, you know, whatever their purpose is. And that if we think of them in those terms instead of as people, that would put them under maybe some other kind of rules,
yeah,
like the rules for robots.
Well, excellent point. And I think the entire thing is just an incredible stretch. And, you know, it's the increasingly widely known joke that, you know, I'll believe a corporation is a person when the state of Texas executes one. Or, you know, I'll believe a corporation is a person when California decides they can marry. Or I'll believe a corporation is a person when a corporation buys another corporation and gets prosecuted under the 13th Amendment for violating anti-slavery laws. So, you know,
yeah,
it's or when a corporation buys two corporations and, you know, merges with two corporations and is prosecuted for bigamy or polygamy. And the whole thing, Valerie, what you're pointing out is that the whole thing is absurd on its face. And I'm with you. Thank you very much for calling and pointing that out. And, you know, very well said. Keith in Taos, New Mexico. Got a minute to break. Keith, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted listeners to know that the occupation movement has been organizing against the really outrageous parts of the National Defense Authorization Act, and that there was a number of arrests at the White House. An office was raided after a protest against that in Brooklyn. And there's been a lot of listeners are unaware of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've actually been pulled off of airplanes for being a terrorist, even though I'm a co-founder of Food Not Bombs. And I've had TSA, but the border and customs people come and take me away and interview me for an hour about my association with the so-called, quote, violent group Food Not Bombs.
Wow.
So this kind of, you know, I was just pulled out of my vehicle at gunpoint, entering the United States from Montreal into Vermont.
Wow.
So this happens.
Yeah, this is. I think, you know, what Rand Paul is going through in Kentucky. Keith, thanks for the call. Really highlights, you know, when it happens to a U.S. senator, then the news media can't ignore it. When it happens to Keith, you know, our caller who just called coming in from, you know, Canada, the news can easily ignore it. But they're not going to ignore it with Rand Paul. I hope this starts a national discussion.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Security theater or real security? I mean, if these scanners were so wonderful, why doesn't Israel use them? So, John Boehner wants to hold your tax cut, that is, if you make, you know, under $250,000 a year, he wants to hold your tax, actually, if you make under $106,000 a year, he wants to hold your tax cut hostage so that the Koch brothers and other billionaire oil dynasties can get the XL pipeline all the way down to the Gulf Coast where all the refineries are. It's probably not even mostly the Koch brothers. It's probably mostly the ExxonMobil and whatnot, so that they can refine that oil into gasoline, pump the cancer-causing components of that into the air around Texas, into that cancer alley that goes down along Louisiana and Mississippi and mostly poor neighborhoods, and then export the gasoline. The number one export of the United States right now that is not a raw material. I mean, our number one export, I believe, is lumber. But our number one manufactured export is gasoline. And John Boehner is saying that he's going to hold this thing hostage. This is just mind-boggling. Just absolutely mind-boggling. Mary Jo in Verona, Pennsylvania. Hey, Mary Jo, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. It's nice to talk to you. This is the first time I ever called. I'm a little bit off topic because I was watching your show before this show. So I wanted to speak about how offensive it is that the American people, no, I shouldn't say the American people, the congressmen and the senators and the media address President Obama as Obama. And not President Obama, and how classless that is as a country.
Yeah, although I would submit to you that we did the same thing with President Bush, the same thing was done with President Reagan, the same thing was done with President Clinton. I think that there's a certain American attitude that is opposed to the aristocratic notion of president as emperor that likes to do that. I try to refer to President Obama as President Obama whenever possible, although I fail as well, I'm sure. So I think that that's just, the kind of thing that you see in the United States. I'd be surprised. Although actually I was in the UK, a couple of weeks ago and I saw headlines in newspapers that simply said Cameron, rather than Prime Minister Cameron. So.
Well, I feel as bad then as I thought.
Yeah.
I also wanted to speak about Newt Gingrich.
Mm-hmm.
How when President Clinton was in office, how badly he wanted his throat for the Monica Lewinsky scandal, and at the same time he was having trouble in his own marriage and doing the same thing.
Right, he was going on the floor of the House of Representatives condemning President Clinton and saying things like I don't think this is one of Newt's quotes, but they were all. All these guys were basically him and Livingston, who was having an affair, and Bob Barr, who was having an affair. They were all saying things like, how can you trust a guy to run your government when he can't, keep his marriage together or can't be true to his wife? And then Newt would go leave there and go get it on with Calista while he was still married to Marianne. So, yeah, I'm with you. Newt is a hypocrite. It's absolutely true. Thank you, Mary Jo. Excellent point. Terry in Silver Springs, Nevada. Hey, Terry, what's up?
Hi. Hey, I wanted to just ask a question. I don't know the legal thing, but when you're home, this is about the personhood argument that they make about when you're home, you're a person, with all your rights under the law.
Right.
And then when you go to work, you get to be another person all over again.
Presumably, if you're a CEO.
Here's their argument.
Here's why. And this is another hole in their argument. You're pointing it out, but let me fine tune it a little bit. If a corporation is going to speak. On whose behalf in the corporation is the speaking done? In other words, if a corporation is made up of 1,000 employees, does the corporation, if it's going to speak, have to speak in the voice of the majority of the 1,000 employees? I mean, that's how a union would have to speak. Unions are democracies. But no, corporations can completely ignore the wills or the wishes of their employees. It is the board of directors or it is the senior most officers of the corporation who get to decide what the corporation is going to say, how the corporation is going to use its money to try to influence elections, and the workers have nothing to do with it. So to claim that the right of association gives the right of a, then leads to the right of a corporation to be considered a person and have the right of free speech, I think is demonstrated as nonsense simply by that logic. Make sense, Terry?
Yes. Yeah, it's just for the sociopath at the top.
Yeah, there you
go. To double game the system.
That's right. He's the person who gets double personhood because, you know, he gets to vote, and then he can also use the corporate PAC. Terry, thank you very much. Joe in Shawnee, Oklahoma. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hi. I've been very frustrated by the choice of the payroll tax being forgiven as a way to help the middle class.
I agree.
It ignores the needs of the elderly who are already on, who do not have a payroll tax, and they're the biggest voters. In mass, they vote more than anyone else in the United States. And they, some of them resent the payroll tax being forgiven because they feel like it is undermining Social Security.
This is my concern as well, Joe. And for the moment, it's not because it's taking money out of the general fund to replace that money that would have been coming out of taxpayers' pockets to fund Social Security. But I think that it's
but
a bad precedent.
Call it something else. I'm frankly hoping that he uses it as a way to show up the Republicans when it comes to the fight over the Keystone Pipeline.
Yeah, I hope so, too.
And comes up with another way to help everyone, not just the middle class.
Right, like with a tax credit that, in other words, you know, a check that goes to people of lower income rather than, you know, rather than a deduction, you know, reducing the deduction. I'm totally with you. And this is why Bernie Sanders voted against this payroll tax cut. And I understand his logic and I agree with it, is that it's the nose under the camel's the camel's nose under the tent, under the edge of the tent, of shifting Social Security from being a totally firewalled system. Remember Al Gore talking about the lockbox? From shifting Social Security being its own system into making Social Security part of the general fund. And that's, frankly, I think, a very dangerous thing. Jeremy in Woodland, California. Hey, Jeremy, what's up?
Hey, listen, Tom, just wanted to make a couple of observations about the Newtster.
Yes.
I thought it was interesting the other night in debate he talked about the fact that, in fact, he attacked the moderator for telling him that the question was despicable. And I think what he's doing right now is despicable because as much as Obama ran away from the issue of race in his run for the president, Newt is actually generating the opposite.
Sure.
And I think we've got to keep our eye on the groundswell that comes from the type of campaign that Newt is running, because it definitely has a lot of denotations of racism, particularly when he refers to President Obama as the food stamp president.
Yeah, no, it's clearly dog whistle, racist language, and it's the same as when Ronald Reagan. When he was running the primary and he was talking about the welfare queens, it's the exact same thing. It's calling out to the racist right-wing Southern strategy, Nixon Southern strategy, Republican base. Thank you very much, Jeremy, for the call. Michael in New York City. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom, how you doing? Tom, are you aware who Jonathan Gruber is?
I don't think so.
Okay, Jonathan Gruber, I've known about him for a while. Jonathan Gruber was one of the key advisors in Massachusetts with Mitt Romney with the with his health care act there.
Okay.
And also for the Obama. And I heard him for your viewers and yourself on cspan.org, okay, on January 9th. He had a town hall meeting with somebody else in Seattle, okay?
Right. The point,
and
Michael.
Okay, and listen to this, it's really, really wonderful. I actually want to get in touch with the election re-election committee of Obama to just use sound bites. This is what he said, and I'm quoting him, that Mitt Romney is the hero of health care reform in America. Okay?
Right.
He said that without Mitt Romney, there would never have been health care, that the Affordable Care Act would never have existed.
Sure, because...
He said, he said it was such a Republican bill. He says the Republicans are very, very big. The right is very big on personal responsibility. That's probably
Newt Gingrich used to support individual mandates, and this was the legislation, and thank you, Michael, excellent point. This was the legislation that was proposed by Richard Nixon in the early 1970s, a virtually identical bill. Don in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Don, got a minute to the break. What's up?
Just real quick, we accomplished quite a bit in Wisconsin. And would really like to contribute more to the vote coming up, but can we be sure that the vote is going to be accurate and verifiable?
No, we can't. But, I think the best statement on that I've ever heard was, and I forget who said it, but, he said, if they're going to steal 2 million votes or 3 million votes by having electronic voting machines that they can rig or whatever, then we need to show up with 5 million extra voters. I mean, there just needs to be that much more of us. It needs to be so big and so overwhelming that they can't pull it off, that the red shift, that we overwhelm the red shift. And in the meantime, we need to be talking about how these voting machines are not safe, they're not secure, they're easily hacked, and in many cases, they're not even owned by American companies, which is very interesting. So, it's time to go back to paper in the United States. I've been singing that song for a long, long time. And just the idea that private corporations are counting our vote, which is the basis of our democracy, is wrong.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service, find out what's going on in D.C., see if Rand Paul has been released. We'll be back.
Come on, we the people, now don't be shy, cause we're all getting robbed and we're just getting by. Let's all stand together with the heads held high. It's time we get a piece of the American pie.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman with you, and Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Welcome, Victoria, talkradionews.com.
Thank you very much.
So what's going on today?
The Supreme Court ruled unanimously today that police must obtain a warrant before attaching a GPS tracker to a suspect's vehicle.
Unanimously.
Unanimously. This is very interesting because I thought they might go the other way.
Yeah.
Now, the government said that attaching this to a car's undercarriage was too trivial a violation of property rights to matter, and that if you drove on public streets, you could expect your movements. You had no expectation of privacy, basically, so it was reasonable.
Right.
Now, the justices split 5-4 over the reasoning, but here's what they basically said. Antonin Scalia said that as conceived in the 18th century, the Fourth Amendment's protection of persons, houses, papers, and effects would extend to private property such as an automobile. And he was joined by Roberts, Kennedy, Thomas, and Sotomayor. Now, in a surprising departure, Justice Samuel Alito split from his fellow conservatives.
Right.
He said it didn't only violate property rights, but also an individual's reasonable expectation of privacy. The test the courts used since 67, when it held that warrants were required before police could wiretap a call made from a public phone booth, because the Fourth Amendment protects people and places, not
right.
places.
Right.
And he was joined by Ginsburg, Breyer, and Kagan in this.
Wow.
And he said that a property-based approach was too narrow to guard against the proliferating threats to personal privacy modern technology posed.
Now, this is the second case that I know of this year where Sam Alito has taken a position that has aligned him more with the progressives on the court, or the moderates on the court. There's arguably only one progressive, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but with the middle of the court rather than the hard right. Could it be that because he's the guy who when the president called out Citizens United and he mouthed the, not true during that State of the Union address, could it be that Alito has realized that he screwed up and is rethinking things and is changing his judicial philosophy?
I think he has very definite views on very definite amendments.
I see.
But what I find fascinating is that I don't know this, but I always thought he was a bit of an originalist.
Yeah,
but in this
Scalia.
Decision, he faulted the majority for trying to apply 18th century legal concepts to 21st century technologies.
Oh, interesting, which is the Jefferson principle, that every generation should remake the nation.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is interesting. Now, they all seem to acknowledge that changes in technology are fast outpacing the law's ability to address them. In fact, Justice Sotomayor wrote, "It may be necessary to reconsider the premise that an individual has no reasonable expectation of privacy in information voluntarily disclosed to third parties."
What does that mean?
She said people disclose phone numbers they dial or text to their cellular providers, and she gives other examples like URLs and email addresses. Right. I, for one, doubt that people would accept without complaint the warrantless disclosure to the government of a list of every website they had visited in the last week or month or year.
But Sotomayor is saying that the government should have that right to get that information without a warrant?
She's saying it may be necessary to reconsider the idea that you don't have any expectation.
Oh, I see. In other words, she's saying that it's okay. She's taking the more progressive view of this. I suppose
she's taking the progressive view. She's saying that, yeah, I know that you give away all these things, but maybe we need to reconsider the idea that just because it's out there, the government doesn't have a right to it.
Right. Yeah. Makes perfect sense. Very interesting. Okay. What else is going on?
Well, other things that are going on. There is a Republican primary going on. You may have heard about it. It's going on in Florida, and it's a brawl.
Yes. And is Newt still ahead in the polls? That was what I heard this morning.
Very, very interesting. In two polls, there's an insider advantage poll of likely voters in Florida that has him ahead as of last night. And a Gallup tracking polls come out, as you know. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, Romney was 30 and Gingrich was 25. Today, it came out at 1 p.m. Eastern, Romney was 29 and Gingrich was 28. So Romney dropped a point. And Gingrich gained 3.
Wow.
Nationally.
Nationally?
Yes.
Wow. That's amazing. And in Florida, to what extent, I've seen a bunch of op-eds about this and different people offering different opinions. I'm assuming, though, some kind of consensus is beginning to form about the early voting and what impact that will have. A certain percentage, and perhaps you know the percentage off the top of your head, of Florida voters had already voted as of yesterday, well, as of the time the South Carolina primary happened, the Newt surge.
It's about 225,000 people, and I'm not very good at math. But basically what they're saying is that even if the majority broke for Romney, suppose 50% broke for Romney and 25% broke for Newt, it's not such a great lead for Romney that Newt can't make it up.
Wow. And so tonight's the debate.
Yes.
Romney and Newt, you think they're going to take each other on? I mean, is it going to be fist-to-fist combat verbally, or are they both going to just beat up on the president and see who can do a better job of that?
Well, I think that is what Newt will probably call for at some point, which is that, well, we should be going after Obama. But I think what the Republican establishment is going to look to see is whether the attacks that Romney has made on Gingrich in the last 24 hours, which have been astonished when he's been saying he had to resign in disgrace, he'd resigned after 4 years, he could run for talk show host, he can't run for president, he's a lobbyist, he's selling influence around Washington. Will Romney say that to Gingrich's face?
Amazing. Oh, and breaking news, Elizabeth Warren and Senator Scott Brown signed a ban on Super PAC campaign ads in their Massachusetts race. That's fascinating. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Adrian Moore is the vice president. Dr. Adrian Moore is the vice president of policy for the Reason Foundation, Reason.org, the libertarian think tank institute and publication, as it were. Do I have all that right, Adrian?
Sounds good, Tom.
Okay. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Down in Florida, they're talking about not just privatizing public things like prisons and whatnot, but doing it in secret. On the other hand, Arizona, just last week or the week before, issued a report finding that when they had privatized part of their prison system, that not only did they not save the money that they expected, but it actually cost them more. that the quality of the services being provided were lower, and that they were stopping the privatization of prisons in Arizona. It just kind of makes sense that, you know, a government agency where nobody is trying to skim some money off the top and no stockholders need to be paid and there's no CEO taking $1 million a year salary would be able to run a prison or any other natural monopoly, any other part of the commons, more efficiently and cost efficiently than a private corporation. I don't get it why you guys would support the Florida Senate bill allowing secret privatization.
No, we wouldn't.
Okay. Well, okay. But you object to the secret part, not the privatization part.
Right. You know, privatization is something that should only be done when it does make sense and when it does work, and it takes effort and you know, good judgment and good sense to make it work, just like it does to make any other policy practiced inside or outside of government. And so you've got to do that. You can't just say, well, hey, privatization has worked in some cases, so therefore if we privatize anything, it will always work. That didn't turn out to be the case in Arizona. And Florida has a very interesting, and I think actually most of your listeners would be intrigued by the broad concept they're trying to pursue through this privatization. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, they're choosing to do some very strange and unaccountable things in the way they, they're considering, I should say, some very strange and unaccountable approaches to doing it, which is really unfortunate.
Right. And so while you and I may disagree on exactly what should be privatized or when or what the parameters should be, in fact, I'm sure we do, I'm pleased to hear that we agree that the idea that privatization, if it's going to be done, another great example of privatization that didn't work out all that well was the privatization of the parking meters in Chicago. You know, it's been a disaster. And there's a long list of things that you know, we could point to. But that even whatever it may be, that if it's going to be done by a government agency, if we, you know, function in this constitutionally limited representative democratic republic, that it has to be transparent. There has to be a level of transparency. There should be public debate. There should be, witnesses and hearings and whatnot. There should be a serious discussion of the issues, and then there should be a public vote. And what in Florida is considering doing is passing a law that would give, what, the legislature or just Governor Rick Scott the power to simply privatize something at the snap of a finger, the way that Governor Rick Snyder up in Michigan is doing right now with his czars that he's appointing to take over cities and kicking out the publicly elected mayors and city councils.
It's a little more complicated than that. They are they're considering giving the legislature the authority to make decisions about what should be privatized, since they're the elected representatives, and they would then direct the government agencies who are charged with those things to figure out how to make that happen, and then do some analysis showing what the effects of that is going to be. And of course, kind of the first thing I think most people think of when they think of that is, well, before the legislature says, yay, verily, we want you to privatize something, shouldn't there be some analysis that shows that there's going to be a good outcome from that, and that you're going to achieve some demonstrable goals with some measure assurance that you're going to achieve those goals or something like that? And that they seem to be kind of dancing around that.
Well, here's a couple of examples. I mean, if Rick Scott, well, actually, the private prisons, I think, is probably the very best example. There's actually a private prison industry in the United States. In fact, a couple of years ago, it was the single fastest growing industry in the United States in terms of building bricks and mortar on the ground in the United States. And they have a huge lobby here in Washington, D.C. They spread around millions of dollars here in D.C. and in state capitals all around the country. And much of what they're lobbying for is not the further privatization of prisons. They're getting that. Much of what they're lobbying for is things like harsher drug sentences. In other words, more customers, more involuntary customers.
You got to get your facts right. That's absolutely just flat not true. The latest analysis I saw of the lobbying spending by the prison industry demonstrated quite clearly that they have spent virtually nothing on lobbying for criminal issues for tougher sentencing or any of that. They have most of their money has been directed towards lobbying for additional private prisons. And in fact, the Prison Guards Union, the CCPOA, in California alone spent twice as much as the entire prison industry in the United States spent on lobbying in 1 year. It's the Prison Guards Unions, the state prison guards unions, that lobby every
right, who don't want their jobs privatized
for sentencing laws.
So why would it? Okay, I'm perfectly willing to stand corrected. If you've examined these and the reports that I've seen have been hysterical or something, I'll have to go back and look at the facts. But let's assume for a moment that what you said is absolutely right and I'm totally wrong, and that the private prison industry has not lobbied for laws that would give them more customers. At what point will they begin doing that? And why would they not?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's been 20 years since the industry really got started, and they haven't so far. So I would say it's a long ways away. And in fact, this Florida example that you're looking at is it kind of an interesting in this context, because the idea there is Florida has had a very steady recidivism rate for decades. The majority of the people released from the prison system go back into the prison system. They've made no progress whatsoever in reducing that. And the concept behind privatizing a block of prisons is to have the contract be, look, you can spend the same amount of money that we're already spending. We're not looking necessarily for cost savings here. What we want is for you to guarantee a reduction in the recidivism rate. So you're going to do programs, training, education, whatever things you want to do. But if you don't deliver those reduced recidivism rates, then we don't pay you the full amount. So it's paying these private
I get the concept, but the point is, again, why would you want a private for-profit industry to be involved in the criminal justice system? This, you know, I mean, at what point are they going to be looking at you and me and saying, you know, hey, we can make some money here?
Well, but how would that be worse than what we've already got, Tom? We already have the existing.
Well, who is lobbying to keep the drug laws so strong? Who is paying for that?
What's that?
Who is lobbying to keep the drug laws so strong?
I haven't seen a lot.
I mean, is it the tobacco lobby, the alcohol lobby, the you know what? Who?
Yeah, it's it's the crazy tough, you know, the crazy tough on crime kind of.
So maybe it's the
locking people up.
The lobby of the industry that makes the weapons that and the police, you know, use.
No, they're not the ones lobbying for it. You know, tough on crime is popular with conservatives. You don't need to lobby a lot on it, unfortunately.
Yeah. Okay. Adrian Moore, Reason.org, the Reason Foundation, the VP for Policy. Adrian, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Interesting conversation. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, should we be privatizing our prisons? Should we be privatizing anything that's a natural monopoly? Shouldn't we say, you know, there's only one power line coming into your house? The power should come from the city. Okay, welcome back. The Justice Policy Institute released a comprehensive report. This is from an article in Salon called How Private Prisons Game the System. The Justice Policy Institute released a comprehensive report in June called Gaming the System that comprehensively laid out the tactics private prison companies exercise to push for tougher sentencing policies that add to the private prison population. Because they make more money. While their strategy is largely built, again, quoting from Salon, while their strategy is largely built around campaign contributions and lobbying, they also cultivate and maintain, they being the private prisons, cultivate and maintain special relationships with current and former elected and appointed officials, which can lead to disastrous consequences. And then they go into the detail of this and some of the horror stories associated with it. But that's interesting. It's unusual that that I'll put out an assertion and a guest will say, no, you're completely wrong. And I'm completely wrong. Usually I have some background. I've seen several studies like this, and I know that the private prison industry has lobbied for stronger sentencing. And so, you know, there it is. Now it's on the record. You can read it over at salon.com. It was an article from last year, January 1st, 2011, How Private Prisons Game the System. And it's right there. David in Austin, Texas. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I got a couple of questions. One is, what do you know and think about the development of the Justice Party in the Rocky Anderson campaign? And the other is, given that our electoral process is already seriously corrupted by corporate money and destined to become more so, at what point does our participation just lend credence to fraud?
Well, if the limit of your participation is just to vote and mouth the slogans of a particular political party, then you're right. You know, the extent to which a political party may be corrupted, you're complicit in that. If, on the other hand, your idea of participation in a political party is to show up and say, I want to volunteer to be a committee precinct person, and I want to help write the platforms, and I want to be the person who helps decide who the primary candidates are going to be, then I would say what you are doing is decorrupting or uncorrupting the party, and that would be a good thing. With regard to Rocky Anderson and the Justice Party, Rocky's been a guest on this show, and he's a good, solid progressive, and the Justice Party is, you know, a new third party that is emerging. It's fairly very small right now compared even to the Greens. And my concern is that until we first get instant runoff voting coast to coast or some parallel version of it like in New York State, where you can be on the ballot of two different parties. You can run on the Progressive Party in New York and the Democratic Party, and so people can vote progressive and still vote for that same person. Fusion voting. Until we either have instant runoff voting or fusion voting nationwide, that what happens is that third parties tend to hurt their own side by siphoning votes off. And although Ralph Nader did not cause Al Gore to lose the election in Florida, the mythology that he did has some basis in truth. I mean, the mythology, the concept. Even though that's not actually what happened. What happened was that Catherine Harris knocked 80,000 African Americans off the voting rolls, and then when the state ordered a recount, had the recount actually been done, they would have found that Al Gore even then still won the state of Florida. But all of that aside, have I answered your question?
Yeah, you made a good shot at it. I'm still, you know, puzzled. I'm in, of course, in a red state that's not going to, where my vote is pretty irrelevant to begin with. So I'm sort of thinking, what can I do with it besides, you know, thank goodness I'm not in a swing state where I would have to vote for Barack Obama. Well, and, you know, the other question is, like, what would you advise to people who are in a position like I am where our vote is not going to really register? I'm looking for some place to give it.
Well, you're in Texas. You know, Texas used to be a Democratic state. The reason that Jack Kennedy took Lyndon Johnson on was because he needed Texas to be in his side, and Texas was a solid Democratic state. And I think that
what did Lyndon Johnson say when he signed the Civil Rights Act?
Yeah, he said we're going to lose the South for a generation. Well, that generation is dying off. And the racists among us, the racist vote among us, when you look at the demographic of it, it's typically people over 50. It's white people over 50 and some over 40. But you don't find so much racism in people under 30, and regardless of race. And so, I think that I would say, you know, let's try and take back the state of Texas. I mean, you know, let's get involved in the process. That would be, you know, call me Pollyanna, but I would not give up and say, okay, I'm just going to go, you know, spit in the wind. I mean, it doesn't seem like it would work. David, thank you for your call. Sorry to cut you off there. I want to let at least one more caller in here before the break here. We got a whole bunch of them. David in Los Alamos, New Mexico. David, got a minute to the break. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Great program. So what do you do when you talk to somebody who's, what do I do when I talk to somebody who's obviously getting their current events information from Fox and Rush Limbaugh?
Well, I suggest to them that if they really think that fair and balanced, whatever, if they really want to know both sides of the issue, if they want to be able to have an intelligent debate with me, they should understand my point of view. I actually read the right-wing websites, and so I understand theirs. And so I would call on their intellect, as it were. I would challenge them to raise their intellectual horsepower a little bit by reading the progressive websites, you know, and give them a half a dozen of them to read, or even one or two, and then say, and then let's have a conversation.
Well, what I say to them is, to talk with you is like talking about evolution with an evangelical Christian. You know,
they've
got their Bible. I have my Origin of the Species.
Yeah, but David, that's an ad hominem. That's attacking the person. That's telling them basically that they're closed-minded. I would challenge them to be open-minded. I would push for a positive outcome rather than point out the negative one.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the good, the bad, and the incredibly some new vocabulary word, ugly, right after this. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very fidifrigously ugly. The good. The 99% movement. Young activists broke up a state of the energy industry gathering on Sunday to preach the message of the 99% movement. The annual event included addresses from some of the largest corporate oil lobby groups, such as the American Petroleum Institute and the American Gas Association, hyping up the benefits of dirty fossil fuels. But members of the 99% were on hand to fight back. They mic-checked the event, yelling, "Big oil's lies are hurting Americans, our economy, and our environment. And big oil is raking in record profits at the expense of the American people." It's great to see the 99% movement is alive and well and directly going after those who perpetuate corporate greed in America today. The bad. Georgia Deputy Chief Judge Michael Malihi. Judge Malihi ordered President Obama to appear in court in Atlanta on Thursday for a hearing on a complaint arguing President Obama isn't a natural-born citizen and therefore can't be president. A Georgia resident filed the complaint in an attempt to keep President Obama's name off that state's ballot in the state's presidential primary in March. This lawsuit is one of dozens filed across the country as part of the birther movement that just won't seem to go away despite the president having released his birth certificate last year. However, this is the first of such lawsuits to actually have some form of success. It's nothing new that people are questioning the citizenship of President Obama, but the fact that a judge has actually given into such nonsense is absurd. And the very, very ugly, the Tennessee Tea Party. A Tennessee Tea Party is going all out to remove references to slavery from American history textbooks. The Tea Party members who idolize America's founders don't want students to know that our founders were flawed and many of them actually owned slaves. Remember Michelle Bachmann trying to claim that the founders fought tirelessly to end slavery? Plus, there's the added benefit that if students grow up not learning about slavery, then conservatives can get rid of all those pesky affirmative action laws, and Newt Gingrich can get away with calling minorities just plain lazy. Members of the Tea Party have tried to do many crazy things with their newfound popularity and influence, but trying to rewrite our nation's history books and censor textbooks? That's very, very ugly. I mean, it just doesn't get much uglier than that. So, one more thing that I've learned about how the criminal justice, the private prison industry basically lobbies for stricter drug laws and other kinds of laws that give them more customers. In Arizona, for example, I think it was 30 out of 36 of the legislators, might have been 33 out of 36, who worked on the papers, please law, that would dramatically increase the population of prisoners by virtue of, you know, identifying people who might be illegal immigrants. Those legislators were explicitly supported. Their campaigns were funded in part by the private prison industry. And so the way that they do it is not going in and saying, okay, we're here to lobby in favor of three strikes and you're out. Instead, what they do is they find those legislators who are saying, I'm in favor of three strikes and you're out, and they say, here's a bunch of money, we'll make sure you get elected. The effect is the same, right? I mean, the effect is very much the same. Chad in Portland, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Chad, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hey, I just wanted to promote a book that, you know, I think I may have heard of it from you even several years back. It's called Prison Profiteers, and it talks about the private prison industry and how the lobbyists go about, you know, promoting the private prison industry, and they do a really good job in that book of explaining everything.
Yeah, yeah, and, it's all out there to see.
I definitely recommend that.
Yeah, it's all out there to see.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Randy in Sioux City, Iowa. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Good. What's on your mind?
I'm trying to I can't draw a parallel to this, but over in Germany in the early 70s, I was in the service there, and they had terrorist acts like bombings and
yeah, the Baader-Meinhof gang.
Right. And Germany didn't go overboard and create a whole new industry over that. I wonder, you know, why we have.
Because well, and it wasn't just Germany. You had the Baader-Meinhof gang in Germany. You had the Red Brigades, I believe they were called, in Italy, who not only were doing acts of terrorism, they kidnapped Aldo Moro, the prime minister, and he died in the trunk of a car. I mean, you know, this is serious stuff. I mean, that would be like, you know, killing the president. I think he might have been the previous prime minister, but he was still, you know, he was a big deal politician. And then, of course, you had the Irish Republican Army that nearly killed Margaret Thatcher. So there were acts of terrorism going on all across the European continent. And then there was the, you know, ETA, the Basque separatist group in Spain, and, you know, blowing up things in Madrid and Barcelona, mostly in Madrid. And so you had all of these things happening. And you're right. None of those nations got hysterical. None of them went down the George Bush path. None of them created their own gitmos. None of them created a supranational security state. And the reason why I would submit to you that we did and they didn't is because in those countries, it's very, very difficult for a private industry like a weapons industry or a war industry to own a politician. That the politicians are much more answerable to the people than they are to the private interests. And if you drive around the suburbs around where I'm sitting here in Washington, D.C., go up north in the suburbs of Virginia, right around D.C., you will find miles and miles and miles of gated communities. Thomas Frank has a great video of this on his website. I think it's thomasfrank.com, where he actually goes out in a car, you know, with a video camera. Miles and miles and miles of gated communities with not just McMansions. These are like 20 and 30 bedroom mansions with servants' quarters attached, with, you know, 10 or 15 bedrooms for the servants. And these are the executives, the senior executives in the defense industry and in the weapons industry that has increasingly become the police military industrial complex, the militarization of our police. It's all the same companies. And you know, they own politicians here. They don't own they didn't own politicians in Italy back then, or Germany, or the UK. That's my theory of it. Does it make sense, Randy?
Yes, yes. It
okay.
Sounds great.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the call.
Thanks
for pointing
much.
It out. I appreciate it. Gary, New Leipzig or Leipzig, North Dakota? How do you say it?
Yes, sir. Tom, the gentleman gave the answer to why they aren't lobbying as much as they would, perhaps, in the for-profit prison system. And it's tougher prisoner-on-prisoner laws, where they can get somebody in for 18 months and then set him up for an in-prison crime and make it 5, 10, or essentially life.
Ah, okay. Yes, I'm familiar with those laws. And again, in some cases, they're actually explicitly lobbying for these laws. But more often than not, what they're doing is they're finding legislators. And in a way, I guess this is sort of what my guest was saying. You know, this is just a conservative mindset. So they find legislators who are just all gung-ho for these kind of things, and they just support them like crazy because they know that that's going to help their particular interests. Excellent point. Richard in Yorkville, Illinois. Hey, Richard, what's up?
How are you, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Richard. What's on your mind?
I will get better, too. I have a suggestion for the two people that were talking about running into the completely hard far-right conservatives that won't listen to a word. Is you don't have to listen to them. You just state the point blank fact that I've got irrefutable evidence from the GAO on the biggest topic in the papers, and what everybody talks about is the debt. Well, the numbers are right there on the GAO accounting to October 1st of each year, and you tell them here's the year that Reagan started, and here's the year that Reagan ended, it tripled.
Yeah.
Bush 1 started, it doubled. Then Clinton, it's right there, year by year. Clinton only raised $1 trillion, and then it doubled again with Bush 2.
Yep.
That's the biggest thing that they're fighting about. I go to bars and truck stops because I'm in my retirement driving a truck. They're the hardest people to talk to because they jump down your throat. You just don't talk to them. You just say, well, here's the point-blank evidence on my side. What's your point-blank evidence? Take a look at this. And then they'll try and refute it, but you just point to the website that it's the GAO accounting office. I mean,
right.
You can't fight that. That's the biggest point they're fighting now.
Yeah, yeah, I know. They're you know, Obama ran up the biggest debt in history, blah, 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 blah. Well, yeah, it was handed off to him by 30 years of Reaganomics and these insane policies that ran it up. Richard,
discuss that.
Yeah.
You just carry a couple copies of that and hand it to him and say, here, look at the facts.
There you go. And there's a great graph. There's a great graph of that over at the Center for American Progress, did it for thinkprogress.org. Thank you, Richard. Excellent point. Mike in Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Great. What's up?
Just an observation, a couple comments. Watching the Republican debates was like watching episodes from the Twilight Zone.
Sometimes.
And so I got to thinking, you know, if we used what we would loosely term logic in their perpendicular universe. And looking at red state, blue state analogy, I'd have to say those damn commies. And then the other observation is Dennis Kucinich, Cleveland, is an excellent point to bring up about privatization.
He fought the privatization of their power system in that city.
And they brought him back and gave him an award because he was right.
That's right. That's right. Although at the time he personally lost that battle. I think he lost his mayorship over that. Did he not?
Yes. Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then after the fact, everybody realized that Dennis Kucinich had been absolutely right. And then they elected him to represent them for Congress and have all these decades. And now he's
president right now.
Yeah. Now he's in this tough primary battle. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. And excellent point. Very well said. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program here with you. Broadcasting coast to coast, border to border, and all over the planet.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And what's going on with the super PACs, by the way? Oh, and what does Newt have to say about Mitt? I'll share that clip right after this.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
So, John Boehner, this actually, I want to go with clip six on this, Jacob. This is amazing. John Boehner on the State of the Union. You know, the president's going to give the State of the Union speech tomorrow night, the same day that Mitt Romney, by coincidence, total coincidence, is going to release his tax returns. No attempt to compete there. But anyhow, here's what Boehner had to say about this.
Read a lot about what the president's going to talk about Tuesday night. And that sounds to me like the same old policies that we've seen. More spending, higher taxes, more regulations. The same policies that haven't helped our economy, they've made it worse. And if that's what the president's going to talk about Tuesday night, I think it's pathetic.
Haven't helped our economy, they've made it worse. Let's see, when President Obama came into office, we were losing 750,000 jobs a month, and now he's had 22 continuous, straight, uninterrupted months of private sector job creation. And our economy is worse? John Boehner lives in an alternative universe. Now, I'm not saying our economy is where it should be, and I'm not saying that I agree with all of the policies and everything that's happened up to this point. You know, I'd love to see our trade policies change. I'd love to see a national energy policy. I'd love to see a national manufacturing policy. But these things are certainly not going to happen with Republicans controlling the House of Representatives. I mean, and with a Republican in the White House? Whoa. Eva in Los Angeles listening to K-Talk. Hey, Eva, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks to you and Stephanie for keeping me sane or helping to keep me sane. Back to the corporations are people. You know, a lot of this, by the way, sounds like Alice in Wonderland, only much more grim. But tell me that it can't lead to a point where hate groups are considered people.
Well, I think they are already by the Supreme Court. I'm not sure that Citizens United would identify themselves as a hate group. And I don't know if the Southern Poverty Law Center has identified them as such, but they had put together what provoked this entire Supreme Court decision was this group, Citizens United, this right-wing conservative group, had produced a movie. I think it was 30 minutes. It might have been an hour, but it was a movie that was a hit piece on Hillary Clinton. And it was during the primaries when Hillary was going up against Obama, and they wanted Obama to be the Democratic nominee because they thought as an African American with a funny name, he would be very easy for John McCain to beat. And so they wanted to take down Hillary Clinton, and they were going to air this thing on TV or in theaters or whatever. And the Supreme Court ruled that under McCain-Feingold, which said you can't do political advertising, outside groups can't do political advertising 90 days out from a primary, from an election. That they couldn't do it, that this theater, this theatrical production was actually a political ad. And so Citizens United took that ruling against them by the Federal Election Commission, the FEC, which is why it's called Citizens United versus FEC, to the Supreme Court. And then the Supreme Court used that as a lever to just pop open the whole can of worms. And so, yeah, Citizens United itself was a nonprofit organization, like a lot of the hate groups are. Like a lot of the hard right churches are that preach segregation and the, you know, the white citizens groups and whatnot. So yeah, I'd say they're already there. You identified a good one. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey Armin, what's on your mind today?
What do you want to bet that the real reason the justices ruled against the GPSs on citizens' cars were because they, through their intelligence operandes, found that they themselves were going to be targeted by the government?
Well, I think it's pretty slim, but Clarence Thomas might be thinking like that. I don't know. It's an interesting theory, Armin. Let me think about that for a while and get back with you. Philip in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Philip, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, this is the first time I've seen your program, and you caught my eye and my thinking on that, but There was one thing that I wanted to say, and I don't know if it doesn't really go with any other topics, but it is a problem that we have in the United States, is our Social Security problem. You know, I spent a couple of hours with this young lady over the weekend. She's about 35. She has some medical problems. The girl has never worked in the industry, you know, just a regular job, but she is gaining benefits from the Social Security. I think she gets like $600 and some. But how do they justify, say, for instance, if part of the Social Security is so that when you retire, how do they explain that to you, and how do they make us feel that that's part of an income?
Right. There's several pieces to Social Security, and when it was originally proposed, it began as basically just for retired persons, and then very quickly what was added to it was survivor's benefits. So it was for first for people who were retiring as a basically a pension, and then secondly they said, okay, now what about widows and orphans? And of course in the 1930s there were not many women in the workforce. That really came with and after World War II. And so what about widows and orphans? And so they added that to Social Security. And then the question became, well, what if the head of household is incapable of working? You know, what about people who are destitute? Social Security should incorporate them. And then things like a very good friend of mine, Michael Hutchison, lives in Phoenix and down in New Mexico. And he was out jogging. He fell off a bridge and broke his neck. He's paralyzed from the neck down. He's destitute. He owns nothing. He was an author. You know, he didn't have a pension or a lot of money. And so he's on Social Security. About a third, and he's probably in his early 60s now. A third of, or late 50s, about a third of all Social Security benefits paid out right now are being paid out to widows, orphans, and disabled people. So if that young woman, you know, 35, was getting money from Social Security, it was because she is somehow disabled. And I think that that's something that that's part of the social safety net. That's how we keep our country. We keep people from falling through, and we don't end up looking like Bombay, where you walk down the street and see people literally dying on the streets, and children chasing you around begging. So, Philip, that's why, and I think it's a good thing, frankly, and I think more people need to know about it so that young people will realize the Social Security is there for them, too. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. We'll see you tomorrow. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.